Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The economy is improving a bit, but millions of Americans still struggle to make ends meet. They live each week paycheck to paycheck. Many work multiple jobs, often without steady pay. One new app looks to ease the burden of managing an unsteady income, smoothing the gap between the money earned and money spent to live. Joining us now is New York Times writer and columnist Anand Giridharadas. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here with you.
You wrote that the Federal Reserve found that nearly a third of American households experienced significant income swings, often due to irregular work hours. What do we know about this issue that made it sense to the developers that an app was needed, besides the fact that it was obviously a huge market?
Well, you know, we're living through an enormous change in how people work and earn money that I think is so big and so pervasive and still so fast moving that we don't fully grasp it. And what these developers, like many scholars have noticed, is that a pretty significant number of Americans now have no idea how much money they will have, say, next month, and certainly not next year. And that the consequences of this are not just stress and uncertainty, but the inability to make plans around bills, the cascade of interest and debt and fees that comes with that, not knowing whether you can take your medicine or not, you know, not knowing, essentially not being able to plan a life the way others are able to plan a life and make choices that help you get from one step to the other. So this is a story in some ways. This app called Even was founded by people at the very opposite end of America, people who are doing fabulously well. And these this team that's come together, they used to work at variously Facebook, Instagram, Google, places like that. Some had done very well in those places. And like many people in that world, I think they hungered for a little bit of purpose after building things that frankly maybe didn't help a lot of real people in their real lives. And the founders came upon this idea of the enormous hurt that income volatility is causing in the country. Mm-hmm. And they set about thinking, how do we fix this?
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the tech company Even that is working to help people, find more balance in their life despite the imbalance in what they earn from month to month, week to week, day to day. My guest is Anand Giridharadas. He is a columnist for the New York Times. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So how did Even the people, the developers, even how did they get even approach the problem?
You know, one of the things that is very interesting is when some of these guys have some success, and in fact, this, one of the founders, now the CEO, John Schlossberg, had a little bit of success with an app that he called the solution to the ultimate first world problem, which is, you know, how difficult it is for some white collar workers to have to continually re-enter their password every time they go to the bathroom at the office and then go back to their laptop. Mm-hmm. But he invented an app that solved that extremely urgent, serious problem. And they sold a few hundred thousand copies of that app, and he made, you know, a good amount of money. And so he had a year to kind of give himself some time to sit and think, and he read a lot. And he read scientific journals, and he read the paper, and he read magazines. And he read this article that really arrested him. And the article was headlined, "Poverty Impedes Cognitive Function." Very riveting headline. Hmm. But the article basically said that, you know, as a society, we have a lot of debate about why poor people struggle to kind of hold their lives together. And people on the left will emphasize structural issues. The social structures don't work. The government systems don't work. The job market doesn't work. People on the right tend to emphasize character, right? The poor have bad character. And this article kind of blew through both of those kinds of explanations and said, you know what, there's actually a neuroscience explanation. And in fact, the kind of 11-ball juggle that is poverty, managing all these bills, figuring out when income's coming in, when it's going out, what you can afford, what you can't, actually so rattles and fills poor people's brains that they become like air traffic controllers who are focusing on a potential collision. They lose the ability to look at all the other planes. And John Schlossberg read this article and thought, well, if that is true, and the article, by the way, said that there's a drop equivalent to 13 IQ points in poor people if you simply bring up money troubles to them in conversation, not even their own money troubles. If you just go up to them and you bring up the idea of money troubles in a mall and then test their IQ, it drops 13 points relative to people who you don't do that with.
And so they thought there had to be an app for that.
There had to be an app for that because that is their hammer.
So how does the app work?
It's a very simple concept. The idea is, this is a kind of insurance. But notably, it's self-insurance. It's not the government insuring you or other people insuring you. What you do is you hook the app up to your real-life bank account. You give it your details. And the first thing the app does is scan the last 6 months of your direct deposit. And it'll figure out, okay, so you got paid $200 last week, $500 the week before, $150 the week before that, going back a few months. And it'll figure out what is your average. Now, the average is not a real average. It figures out your real average, and then it comes up with a number a little bit lower than that to be safe, which it figures it's going to pay you regularly every either week or 2 weeks to give you a steady pay. So what will happen is, let's say it calculates your average at $250. Next time you earn just $200, it'll actually transfer an extra $50 to your account. Next time you earn $300, it'll take 50 from your account and store it in your even account. And then that even account, you know, helps you essentially lend yourself money in the bad weeks, or it starts to build up a savings cushion, which is kind of really their goal, to help people build up their own savings cushion.
Now, I'm going to ask you, you know as well as anyone, given what you do and write about, that a lot of poor people don't have savings accounts.
Right. And so, you know, one of the things that is problematic with this app is it doesn't touch the millions of Americans who don't even have an account, as you say. It also, you know, because it's a self-insurance product, helping people who have good weeks fund their own bad weeks, it doesn't help people who tend to mostly have bad weeks. And that is not a small number of people in the America that we have allowed ourselves to start living in. So, you know, this app may not help people who are kind of regularly unable to make ends meet. And, you know, it, in some ways, although it's a fascinating case of privileged people going into the lives of underprivileged people and trying to help, there are perhaps limitations to that.
It sounds more like it'd be very useful for sort of the new economy of people who are not working regular jobs, like they're not planning on working someplace for 30 years. They're bouncing around more. They're more flexible. They're going to take a year off and work on a organic farm in Hawaii instead of continuing with their 9-to-5 job.
Which sounds great.
It does sound good. I know somebody is doing that. That's what I thought
I mean,
of that.
I think it's, you know, I mean, setting aside the taking a year off part, because that makes it a bit more complicated. But you're right that there's a kind of upper, you know, a slightly more fortunate income volatility problem and a slightly less fortunate income volatility problem, right? So there are people who are choosing now, you know, but choosing is always a complicated idea, but choosing to be Uber drivers or, you know, Instacart grocery delivery folks. And there is a whole new kind of on-demand, again, app-enabled economy in which people, you know, work a series of gigs. And some do it out of choice, some do it because they can't find anything else, but some people genuinely enjoy the freedom, and this app is perfect for them. They probably make enough money on the whole to make it work, et cetera. You know, the average Uber driver has a lot of volatility, but they make pretty decent money compared to a lot of other people with volatile incomes who simply, you know, are making $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, $12,000 a year, you know, getting 4 hours a week at the retail store where they work when in fact they would want 30 or 40, that kind of thing. There's no app for that.
What does even do to be profitable?
It charges a weekly fee for the use of this service, which is $3, and is not, you know, which is not cheap when you add it up to a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it right now makes money in no other way, and claims that it has no plan to make money in any other way. So, you know, its argument is that it's like a subscription service. The mm-hmm. way you pay a monthly fee to Netflix and then you watch however much you want. The idea here is you pay $3 a month and you get this smoothing service. And, you know, one of the real advantages for some people will be that if you have a few bad weeks and you need even to essentially be lending you money, even if you haven't built up a cushion, they give you interest-free credit. Whereas right now, poor people in that situation will often go to payday lenders and the like and pay interest rates when annualized are in the hundreds of percent.
Well, that's where the real altruism comes in, interest-free credit. How can anybody use this?
I think you have to qualify to use it, in the sense that they have to look at your bank account, you have the right kind of accounts and all of that.
Uh-huh.
Right now, it's still only available to beta testers, and they're slowly rolling it out, I think, to a few thousand people by the end of the summer, and then to anybody who signs up and kind of passes their verification by the end of the year.
And so how has the beta testing been going? Do you know?
I spoke to someone who used it. Again, this person was not someone, you know, living in the kind of dredges of the economy. It
mm-hmm.
was an occupational therapist assistant in Michigan and, making what I would say is a kind of pretty solidly middle-class living, but very volatile, because he was paid kind of by the patient, and sometimes there were patients and sometimes there weren't. And he said he found it incredibly helpful. Because, and he gave a simple example of how he had a small detail of switching a lot of his payments from his credit card to his debit card. And I said, why did you do that? And he said, well, I now know exactly how much is coming in, so I know how much I'll have, so I can safely put a payment, a recurring payment on my debit card instead of borrowing every month with all the kind of peril that involves. So I think in ways big and small, it can start bringing the kind of predictability to poor people's lives that, you know, the rich people have been enjoying ever since kind of they were around.
Hmm. Well, Anand, I want to thank you for joining us today to talk about it. Appreciate your time.
Appreciate yours. Thank you.
Anand Giridharadas, he is a columnist for The New York Times. We'll put a link to his article about the Even app on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A local startup called Nikola Labs, named after the scientist Nikola Tesla, who helped revolutionize electric power, is developing a new kind of phone case. The case will, they say, not only protect the phone, which is paramount of importance to me, but also harness the radio frequencies emitted for service to increase battery life. Joining us now are the company's founders, Will Zell, CEO of Nikola Labs. Welcome.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here today.
And also Dr. Chi-Chi Chen, Associate Professor at the OSU College of Engineering. Welcome to the show, Dr. Chen.
Good to be here.
Tell us, Dr. Chen, about the science behind this. It's a simple language, I guess, in as simple a language as you can.
Right. So, as you know, your phone is transmitting lots of energy, but most of them are actually not being actually used at any given time for making the calls or download data. So lots of them actually is going around wasted, either go to your hand, your brain, or environment.
So, is it bad to go to your brain? We've heard those.
Well, science is still debating,
okay.
Studying that.
Right.
That's long-term fact.
But that's not what this show is about, so go ahead.
Right. So basically, our technology was to basically collect those energy which is not being used for actually for the communication, and then convert back to the power, DC power, and then put back to the form. So that's how we think this is going to be useful.
And you did it by converting the radio waves into battery power, and you collect them in the
skin.
The skin.
Yeah.
Is it a nice, highly rubberized one like the one I have to have on my phone?
Yes.
Okay. How does it work?
So the interesting thing about it, the technology, is it works very passively, right? So as you're using your phone, you know, throughout the day, I use my phone, you know, I rely on my phone, I use it, you know, constantly throughout the day.
Uh-huh.
It's transmitting the energy in this case, the technology integrated into the case passively works to take some of that wasted energy and convert it into DC power. And what we're actually doing is slowing the discharge rate of the battery. So it's not charging your battery, right?
Okay.
You'll never go from 30% to 35% just with this case, but we will slow the rate at which your phone discharges, the rate at which it goes from 100 to 0.
So you have more time on your phone.
Yeah.
It extends your battery.
Yes. By about 30%, up to 30%.
How does something that's separate from the battery affect the battery, Dr. Chen? How does something like, you know, like a case,
right,
that's not connected to the battery, right?
Yes.
Or is it?
Well, we are connected to battery.
How does that work?
So there is an electrical wires at bottom of case which your phone is plugged into.
Okay.
That's how we charge the power back to the battery of your phone.
So it's a lightning port, like any charger. When you put the phone into the case, it'll plug in. And you won't have to take the case out to recharge your phone when you need to. So there's an extra port in there to plug in your standard lightning charger. But the idea is when the phone's in the case, it's recycling that energy through and adding it back into the battery.
You're working with the Ohio State University's Technology Commercialization Office.
Right.
What's that been like working through them?
Oh, so the technology, we have four total co-inventors and all with the electrical computer engineering department, and we as a company, they saw this technology is very good, so they licensed the technology through the OSU.
Yeah, and so from I'm an entrepreneur in the community, obviously very familiar with Ohio State and the TCO office, and frankly, it's been great to work with them. So we started talking with Dr. Chen about the technology and working with Eric Wagner at the TCO late last summer.
Uh-huh.
And it's been great. I mean, I think there's often some misconceptions out there about the TCO, but from a very practical perspective, they were with us every step of the way. And just recently we signed the license on the technology. So it's been a very positive experience.
So how did you two find each other?
Well, it was actually through the TCO.
Oh, TCO.
Yep. Yeah.
So you went to them.
Yep.
You went to the Technology Commercialization Office at Ohio State, and you said, I have this idea?
So I had actually an idea for a different product that involved wireless power. And I went to the TCO and said, hey, you know, this is the idea. Is there anyone within the university that works in this area? And they said, you need to meet Dr. Chi-Chi Chen. And set introduced us, and we worked a little bit on that product, and then come to find out he had this amazing, beautiful technology that has become the case that I, along with a couple of other partners, and along with Dr. Chen, came together to launch the case with through Nikola Labs.
So, Dr. Chen, why do you need Will Zell?
It's very important. Many of technology developed universities, they goes nowhere just because we don't have people like Will and his investors who can see the future technologies. We want to see to the market. So that's what we call a valley of death in technology. How do you take from a new idea, new technology, to the market?
Uh-huh.
So
it's not something you're particularly good at, apparently.
No, definitely not good at that.
And you do not want me to do anything regarding RF harvesting research.
right.
Right.
So there is a patent now on it.
So we have two technologies that are under provisional patent,
right,
that are going through the process.
And what's the next step?
So the next step, so we last week we had the great opportunity to share and launch the product on stage at the TechCrunch Disrupt event in New York City. And that led to a lot of a great press, and then also tease up our next step, which is a Kickstarter campaign, which will be launching in about a month, where people will be able to come in and pre-buy our case. And so congruently, we're also working very hard on lining up all of our supply chain to actually produce the case. And one thing I'm super proud about is as many parts, as many steps in the supply chain that we can have locally, we are having locally. So the vast majority of our suppliers will be right here in Central Ohio, which is really, really important to us as a company.
What are some other implications of this design, Dr. Chen?
That's a very good question. So the technology itself actually can be applied to any device which has
laptop,
your tablet, mm-hmm. anything can transmit a radio frequency signal. And of course, not doesn't mean all device, their energy are wasted, right? Depend how the antenna is designed. And your phone designs to have very broad pattern because they don't know how you can hold a phone. And that's where this is coming from. And so I think most of the small device, as long as they transmit the radio signals, and this can be applied to.
Uh-huh. All right. So more devices.
Yep.
More things, bigger things going forward, televisions,
yes.
When we have smart televisions what?
So there are a number of different constraints that we'll be working on under and primarily the regulatory side of things with FCC, especially when you're talking about the transmission of energy. So I can't really speak to a lot of that, but we are definitely going to be an innovative company in this space. And between all of our collective ideas, we believe we can bring some pretty interesting products to market that truly genuinely add value to people's lives.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a plan to convert radio waves from your phone into a process to recharge or to channel that energy into your battery, slows the battery use. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned TechCrunch's Disrupt competition. What happens there?
Yeah, so we were actually participating in what they call the Startup Alley, which is a showcase where, you know, hundreds of startups come and just, you know, try to share with the world of the visitors of the conference.
Can anybody go, or do you have to be?
So anybody can go to that, but to become part of their battlefield, the startup battlefield, which is their pitch competition, there's two ways. You can apply months before the event and be selected that way. Or they also choose one company each day of the event to pull from Startup Alley as the People's Choice participant in Startup Battlefield, and that's actually what we were. So it was a thrilling, crazy experience because we found out basically at 3 p.m. That we were chosen, Editorial Choice and People's Choice Award, and then 2.5 hours later, we were pitching on stage in front of
both of
a 1,000 people. So I was there along with Dr. Rob Lee, who's one of the co-founders in the company, and a couple of the other partners.
And how does that work? Is it sort of like American Idol or something?
People are insanity.
Sitting around watching.
Yeah. So there are three judges, three or four judges, and you have 6 minutes to pitch, right? So we introduce the product in 6 minutes, and then about a 6 minute question and answer session, and the questions came from the judges on the stage. So it was a whirlwind, but it was fun, and I think we were able to show the product, obviously, and we got a tremendous amount of feedback and the feedback is if this actually works, we want it, right? And
uh-huh.
And that's the nice thing that we know is the technology works.
The technology actually works.
Yeah.
It's not a question of that, but now it's hard to get it in a product shape and size and everything. Do you actually use them now?
Yes.
Yourself?
Yeah.
What do they look like?
So it looks like a very standard case, and I apologize. I did the bad thing as a founder of a company not bringing the product here. But we do have prototypes out in the field. The nice thing is when you're talking about battery cases or ways to add power, you're typically dealing with very bulky cases. This is thin, really thin profile, sleek design, and it's something that's pretty standard to the case that you have on your phone. Actually, maybe it's thinner than that. It really is like any other protective case.
Why do you decide in the position that you're in, Dr. Chen, I guess, why not license the technology to phone companies or phone case makers that already exist?
That's still an option. Mm-hmm. And we had to prove to them, because most of the phone company, they have long-term plan, not short-term. So I think once we prove the technology works, they're already talking to us now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. They're not out of the equation.
No. Yeah. No. So what we really needed to do is to prove the technology and primarily have customers experience it and love it.
Bill and Gahanna, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just wanted to clear up a common misconception one of your guests talked about. He said that they have a provisional patent, and it's working its way through the patent office. And I'm sure that he knows this, and his patent counsel has told him, but it's good to remember that it's a provisional application, and it just sits in the patent office and does nothing, and nothing wins its way through the patent office until a formal application is filed within 12 months. So a lot of people think that once you file your provisional application, you can sit back and rest, and it is just a stake in the ground. Will wither unless you do something within a year.
Okay. Will Zell?
No, absolutely. Thank you for clarifying that. That is exactly right. We're coming up on our filing deadline. We have two different deadlines it'll get very active after that. So thank you.
That's something, Dr. Chen, that you're very involved in because it's pretty technical stuff.
Right, right.
About the product itself.
We are actually preparing the actual patent filing documents right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. And how is the process from prototype to production going? How many prototypes are out there now, and how do you take that from prototype to mass production, I guess?
Right. And typically, there are two stages of testing we are doing. One is we call a benchtop test, which is like we did that in a laboratory to verify all the specs, everything works as we expected. And then there's a second stage called user stage that we'll be talking about maybe 20 to 50 prototype, which is hand out to some volunteers to use it, who knows nothing about technology, like daily use, like you and me, just put your skin on and then tell us what your experience is. And that will be happening pretty soon, right, Will? And so that would be the usage test, experience test. And so far, we completed the first one. We are preparing the prototype for the second stage, the user test.
Yeah, so it's a pretty complex process, actually, because you're dealing with the development of a printed circuit board as well as the printing of cases and bringing all of those components together. So we're actually working with Juicebox Labs, which is a local company and they do a lot of the industrial design, and they've been great to work with. And the two of us are here, but we've got a team of 10 people who are working on this, and it's been great. So it's definitely a team effort.
Is it being designed to work with any kind of phone, or will the makeup of the phone have to change?
For each phone, we had to do some small design change to make a case for that particular phone. Just like your case for different phone.
Yeah.
Even iPhone, you have different model, you had to change the case.
But nothing about the phone itself?
No.
There's no particular modifications for the phone?
Yes.
And I want to ask you about the Kickstarter idea. Why Kickstarter? This sounds like you have phone companies that are interested. Isn't there...
So Kickstarter, it's less about doing a Kickstarter to try to get a little money to make the product come to life. We're actually using Kickstarter because it's the world's largest platform.
Generate interest.
Yeah, for early adopters of new technologies, and that's what this is. So it is a way for us to really validate our assumptions in the marketplace and a great avenue to allow people to buy into not just the product, but really our vision for Nikola Labs.
And that's starting up soon, right?
Yeah, we're about a month away. So
how do you do a Kickstarter campaign with this? How do you sell it?
So the so that's actually where Juicebox Labs comes into to play. They're also leading that effort for us. So it's to do it well, it's a pretty complex campaign. So we're working today in reaching out and building the relationships that we need to, working directly with Kickstarter, working with companies like Twitter and Facebook that can help us guide our message when we go to do advertising leading up to the campaign. But ultimately, it comes down to our the claim of the technology, the validation of that claim, and then the vision that Nikola Labs has as a company.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today to talk about it. It sounds very interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing one.
Thank you so much.
That's Will Zell. He's CEO of Nikola Labs, and Dr. Chi-Chi Chen, an OSU College of Engineering associate professor and the designer of the technology that we've been talking about that converts radio waves from your cell phone into battery power. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. With the Apple Watch now officially available to the larger consumer market, LG is looking to make its own impact on the mobile watch business. Its newest model, Urbane Watch, is getting good reviews from the critics, but competition in this niche market is stiff. Joining us now by phone to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks.
It's not the first smartwatch from LG. What have they done with Urbane to step up their game?
So the whole point of the Watch Urbane is to take their previous concept, which was the G Watch R, which was their first attempt at a round smartwatch instead of the square smartwatches that we saw from so many of the first generation smartwatch launches, and make it feel more like a premium watch. So the casing is higher quality material, significantly more impact resistant, and just generally looks and feels like a larger, more watch like, I guess is the way to describe that. At first glance, it looks like a traditional watch on the wrist, as opposed to some kind of tech gadget,
like Apple has done with its more angular design. What do you think about that, making it look more like a regular watch or traditional watch?
I think that it looks great, especially the leather band that it comes with looks pretty nice as well, and you can switch it out for whatever band you can buy in a store. I know that our editor-in-chief has been messing with it for a couple of days and switched out for a metal band pretty early on just because he prefers those. But the design, I think that it looks like a higher-end watch, the only downside to that being that if you wear jeans and a t-shirt, then it looks a little out of place on your wrist. And that kind of ends up being the weird trade-off here is that, we're talking about smartwatches as this one device that you wear on your wrist all the time. And that clashes with the more traditional watch, experience where you either have like one, usually like a sport watch that you wear all the time, or you have multiple watches that you wear based on how you are dressed for the day. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see, how they've kind of stepped up. It definitely doesn't look, I jokingly refer to the previous attempt at a round watch as kind of a kid's toy because it looked kind of silly in my opinion. But this is definitely a more, grown-up, adult-looking watch.
As far as how you use it and the design, is it meant to be on all the time?
Sure. I mean, each one of these devices are really designed to be worn as frequently as possible, Apple and Google both have made pretty significant efforts towards selling these devices as, kind of an extension of your phone that makes it so that in some cases you can even, set the phone down if you're in kind of a limited space and you know, be able to do a lot of things through the watch itself, which is, you know, there are some people who are going to think that's important, and there are some who are not going to care about that at all. But it definitely is something that the design, at least from a marketing perspective, is such that you would be wearing it all the time, from the moment you woke up to, you know, when you took it off to go to bed.
The last headline I skimmed today on the Apple Watch, it said something about not necessary, which I thought was, it's, you know, kind of cut right to the heart of the issue. Is the LG Urbane necessary?
I don't think any of these smartwatches are necessary in the same way that we view smartwatches or smartphones as necessary now.
Yeah.
But it's also worth pointing out that, you know, 10 years ago, we were having the same conversation about whether or not smartphones were necessary. So it's hard to gauge from that perspective.
Yeah.
I think that most people are going to find that, you know, that the interaction they have with their phone is more than enough. There's not really a need for a secondary device, you know. But at the same time, if you are the kind of person who are just, you know, really sick of your phone being full of notifications and that weird twitch that you see where someone, you know, every time they hear that ding, that notification ding, they pull out their phone and check. Especially if you're in a group of people and a bunch of people have the same notification tone.
Yeah.
It's really noticeable. And so the smartwatch, I guess, is a way to help deal with that. But it does seem kind of silly that we're talking about a $350 accessory to deal with a problem created by a $700 phone.
First world problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can control the watch and phone with wrist gestures, and that makes me think of the old Google Glass. Was it Google Glass where you had to, like, you know, shake your head or something like that?
Yeah, Glass had a tilt gesture for when you were, you know, in the car or doing something with both hands. And this is a similar function in that you can flick your wrist to bounce back and forth between notifications if you feel it's necessary. And it's something that, you know, it works really well. It's something that I'm surprised wasn't available at launch from Google or Apple. But it's something that, you know, if you have your arms full of stuff and you get multiple buzzes on your wrist, then, you know, you can take a look at those messages while you're doing stuff.
All right. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've just finished talking about LG's watch. It's called Urbane. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Russell Holly, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wanted to talk about Duet Display. We've talked a little bit about this on the show before. Tell us or remind us what Duet Display is, what it does.
Sure. So Duet Display is an application that's designed to extend your desktop originally for Apple MacBooks to an iPad. So you would effectively be able to plug an iPad into a MacBook and you would have a second display. It would remove the functions of the iPad and instead give you a second touch monitor that you could interact with, which, you know, for some people, myself included, is incredibly useful. And today they've announced support for Windows devices. So if you have a Windows laptop or a Windows desktop and you occasionally find yourself in the need for a second screen, you can now plug your iPad or even an iPhone, although those are a little smaller, obviously, into the USB port of any Windows computer and be able to extend that display onto this other device.
And this is where you can kind of move things over from one screen to the next.
Right. Yeah. It's like having a computer with two monitors, and it's very plug and play. It works seconds after you plug it in, and as soon as you disconnect it, then, you know, the computer knows what to do as far as, you know, making sure that the stuff that was on that second display gets moved over to the first display again. So it's all really simple to use.
Was it difficult making the two different operating systems play together?
Oh, I'm sure that it was. I hadn't spent a whole lot of time talking to the developer about it yet, but Windows provides a really interesting challenge for this kind of stuff, because there are so many different ways to configure hardware for Windows, whereas MacBook, there's only, like, you know, 15 or 20 different kinds of MacBooks out there over the last couple of years, and most of them are running very, very similar hardware. So it's easy to, well, it's not easy, but it's less challenging to build for, you know, those kind of specific designs as it is to do something that's more general. And as a result, you know, this first generation of this software, if you have, you know, a really high-end kind of gaming PC that you've built for yourself, there's a good chance that Duet Display isn't going to work just yet because it struggles with, you know, multiple video cards inside of a desktop.
Is there anything else on the market like this?
There are a couple of monitor extensions that do things wirelessly you know, allow you to kind of remotely access your desktop, but they are often, you know, limited by the wireless network that you're on or the kind of device that you're using, and ends up being, you know, a less than stellar experience. And what I really found about Duet that was special was that it genuinely felt like I had plugged a second monitor into the computer. It wasn't struggling to move things around. There wasn't a whole lot of, you know, jerking around in the animations or flickering or anything like that. And you find a lot of those problems in some of the competing products.
Yeah, there's no lag delay problem.
Right. It genuinely acts like a second monitor has been connected.
And can you connect two devices running different versions of iOS?
I honestly don't know. I hadn't tried that. I would assume
I've stumped Russell Holly. Woo-hoo.
You have. I have. I would assume that anything running Duet Display would be able to handle it just fine. But I'm not sure that Duet can actually handle two external devices at the same time. I've never tried it.
I'm sorry. I'm still reeling from the fact that you said I don't know. Very rare words from Russell Holly. This is not a happy day, but certainly notable. If you have a question or comment for Russell Holly, join the party. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Yeah, Amy Jurevich, my associate producer, says mark this date in history. Okay,
I will have the answer too by the end of the night.
Before
the day is done, I will know.
Before the day is done. Okay, Xbox One is getting a software update with some new features. Is this a big deal?
It is. You know, Microsoft has, you know, positioned themselves. They're not as popular as the PlayStation 4 this year. And, you know, a lot of that has been because of, you know, just kind of poor marketing of some of the software decisions that they've made. And you know, Sony pushing really hard to make it clear that they are, you know, in the corner of the video game player and stuff like that. But this last update it seems like a small update, but what they're really adding is more extended control options for the Xbox One, which includes, live voice communication with other players when you're not inside of a game, live voice messages that can be sent back and forth to players when you're not inside of a game. And a lot of this stuff was dependent on, you know, this kind of central piece of software in the past, through Xbox Live, and now it's a lot more flexible, it's a lot more functional to be able to just communicate with the other people that you're playing games with. And they've also made some changes to the Xbox One Smart Glass application, which works on Android and iPhone and Windows, that allows you to control the Xbox remotely. And this includes turning the Xbox on and off now, as well as controlling the television function if you have your TV plugged into it. So it kind of all comes together to feel more like a complete product.
Why do gamers need to leave each other voice messages when they're not there?
A lot of it ends up being just a faster way to send messages than typing, because you have to think about it. There's no keyboard for the Xbox One, so you end up, you know, kind of using your controller to scroll across a keyboard,
right,
that's on the screen in order to send messages, and that can be, you know, kind of tedious and takes a while. And in some cases, that ends up being the only way that you have to communicate with that person. You may not have their email address or something like that. And so voice messages just makes it significantly faster to get in touch with that person or to leave that person a message.
What about the party chat function? There's going to be an update allowing people to use a party chat function. How does that work? Is this where everyone just sits and talks during the game?
It allows for, you know, groups of people who are playing together or people who are, you know, not playing but still want to be involved in the conversation to come together on, you know, the Xbox and use the Xbox as the chat client instead of relying on third-party software.
Okay. How much do they chat during a game?
it really varies. You know, there are some players who are on teams and they play only on teams, and so they are, you know, very socially active with one another. They communicate all the time, particularly in kind of military strategy games or you know, games of a similar nature where it requires teamwork. There's usually a lot of communication there. I am not huge on constant communication through games myself, but I have seen just tons of people really latch onto this feature, not just on the Xbox, but on, you know, PC and PlayStation as well. It's really a popular function for people who take advantage of that kind of team play mechanic to you know, play multiplayer games.
Nintendo Wii has a new game. It's called Splatoon. I like that name, but what does it mean?
It's a silly name for a very silly game that I played with my kids all weekend long and had so much fun with. And the description doesn't get any less silly, which is wonderful. You play these little characters who are these kind of hybrids between human beings and squids. And the squids are capable of swimming through ink and doing these kind of crazy tricks and stuff. And it ends up being a 4-versus-4 game where the people on your team are working to cover a map in as much colorful ink as possible in your color while the other team is trying to do the same. And you have, you know, 3-minute matches in the demonstration that we got to play where, you know, at the end of the 3 minutes, whichever team had covered the map in their color ink by the end had won. And it ends up being really just an incredible strategy experience to kind of, you know, maneuver the other players out of the way and eliminate the other players in order to you know, successfully cover the map with your colorful ink. And it was just very silly, very bright colors. You know, it's modeled after a lot of the common first-person shooters, but it really lacks that kind of violent feel that so many of those games have. So, you know, probably the best and also worst way to describe this is that it's a kid-friendly first-person shooter game.
Okay.
Because, you know, we should totally be encouraging kids to shoot more things, but at the same time, it really was a remarkable strategy experience, and you don't have to angle it towards children as though it is a shooter.
Like a Bloodlust type of game.
Right. It was fun, but every time I go to describe it, I come up against that phrase where it's, you know, it's a kid-friendly shooter. That's I feel good about saying out loud.
The game also focuses on playing online with multiple players.
It does, yeah. So it's a 4-versus-4 game, and the demonstration that I played, you were a single player who was on a team with 3 other people, and there was no audible communication for the demonstration, but there is supposed to be later on where you play against, you know, 4 other random people from around the world. The matchmaking was, you know, was in the demonstration really kind of generic. You could jump on and you know, play with whoever, but the game was uniquely enjoyable for as child friendly as it was, and
meaning,
how very, very silly it was.
And meaning it's good for multiple generations to play together.
Absolutely, yeah. This was something that, you know, each one of my kids really thoroughly enjoyed playing, and I couldn't get enough of it. It was a lot of fun. So that either means that there's further evidence that I am a giant child, or it's something that lots of people can play. I will accept either one.
Are your kids getting old enough now where they get to bring their kids home or their friends home and say, "Dad's always got the cool games first"?
Yes, it's actually kind of a delicate conversation to have, because there was an issue once where my youngest daughter was kind of using it as bragging rights, and I kind of had to dissuade that, because I am under occasionally non-disclosure agreements for games that I'm not allowed to talk about. So
uh-huh.
When my daughter goes to school and goes, "My dad got this game a month early," it causes problems every once in a while.
Oh, the good problems to have, I suppose. Russell Holly, thank you so much for joining us as usual.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, he's a contributing editor for Android Central. Want to thank the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, All Sides interns Michael Hepburn, Shahina Sagiri, Abdulrahman Al-Ruweshan, Ryan McFadden, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter too at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.